This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with one of the activists facing decades in prison, all for being part of peaceful demonstrations against the death by police of Elijah McClain.
You're going to hear what the cops are doing now. They totally overcharge these people. They can send them to prison for years and years for doing nothing.
Ray McGovern joins us to talk about the administration's relationship with Russia.
Ray McGovern was one of the top analysts for the CIA. He's on our side, and he knows what he's talking about.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Let's hear from Jim Lafferty, the former director of the National Lawyers Guild out in California.
What the insurrection of January 6th and the growing number of smaller yet still violent uprisings around America make clear is that a new civil war is brewing and that Christian nationalism is leading the charge. As Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry write in their book, Taking America Back for God, Christian nationalism includes, and I quote, assumptions of nativism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and heteronormativity, along with divine sanction for authoritarian control and militarism. It is as ethnic as it is religious. Understood in this light, Christian nationalism contends that America has been and should always be distinctly Christian from top to bottom in its self-identity, interpretations of its own history, sacred symbols, cherished values, and public policies, and it aims to keep it this way, close quote. And according to Rachel Mikva, writing in the February 25th issue of The Week, quote, an estimated 20% of American adults, most of them white, believe the U.S. should be an expressly Christian country, with biblical teachings guiding every aspect of civic life, close quote. You know, that notion that Jews will not replace us, and Mexican rapists will not replace us, and Muslim terrorists will not replace us. Now, Christian nationalists feel more and more under attack and in danger of losing their grand battle. This form of nationalism explains, I think, the lockstep way that evangelical Christian religious leaders and followers united around a very non-Christian behaving Donald Trump. So long as he stood against the non-Christian aliens taking over America and against abortion rights and other godless programs put forward by the atheist left, he could grab as many women's crotches as he liked. Currently, a very significant number of evangelical Christians have actually interpreted the words from the Bible in Isaiah 45 to mean that Trump, the 45th president, is God's chosen leader here on earth. Now, for its adherents, Christian nationalism provides great benefits. For example, it's highly beneficial to believe that white men and women are the true reflection of God here on earth, and are therefore entitled to the white privilege they enjoy. And certainly very beneficial for its male followers to be in a dominant position over its female followers, and for its female followers to approve of that arrangement. And so, as America becomes ever more populated by people of color, be they born here or coming from foreign lands, the racism, xenophobia, religious bigotry inherent in white Christian nationalism, well, it's become much more pronounced, and it attracts and it provides a cover for violent groups like the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, Jew-hating neo-Nazis, and QAnon followers. Of course, its followers also included, for somewhat different reasons, those who see the Democratic Party as seeking to impose some form of socialism in America, and those who believe in the deep state, and that the mainstream media peddles mostly lies to the American people. You know, people like Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, much in the news recently. And that's a hell of a lot of Americans. Add to them other voters just looking for a tax break or less corporate regulation or a tougher trade deal with China, and you've got 74 million votes for a grifter like Donald Trump. So it's clear how we got to this point in America, this point where some members of Congress are threatening other members of Congress, where people openly call for the assassination of elected officials, where the FBI and Department of Homeland Security warn us really that much worse violence awaits us down the road, where we've got a situation that our nation's capital must be surrounded by fences and barricades and military forces, and where this new civil war, now only simmering, may one day boil over into a much wider and ever more traditional civil war. But what is not yet clear, or at least what has not yet been clearly thought out and explained, is how we put an end to this civil war, how we prevent it from boiling over much more so than it did on January 6th. Surely the majority of us, those of us who don't want to see America travel further and further down a road that ends in authoritarianism, must somehow find the answer and find it before it's too late. Well, I truly believe that the answer can be found. I don't have all of that answer, but for starters, surely, it requires admitting that both current capitalist parties have failed tens of millions of our desperate, largely abandoned sisters and brothers. And they make up the majority of those enthralled to Trump and to QAnon and to countless other internet purveyors of crazy and dangerous untruths. Certainly, the answer must include the passage of very progressive legislation, legislation designed to finally close the ever-growing gap between those who live comfortable lives and those so desperate that they blindly follow Trumpian lies and seek out ever crazier and less safe ports in the storms of their lives. Certainly it requires Christian leaders of goodwill, more openly and forcefully, decrying Christian nationalism. Most critically, it will require, I think, the coming together in action of America's sane and decent majority, the coming together of all those progressive political forces and tendencies that, well, truly believe in an end to the social and economic inequality that prevails in America today. For only then will the tribalism that such inequality has produced begin to lessen and can finally end. Only if we can unite such forces and bring about, at a minimum, a sufficient degree of democratic socialist governance in America can we hope to stop the simmering pot of violent discords from boiling over into a new and fully realized civil war. Can we do this? Can we overcome this crisis? There are some very high hurdles standing in our way. There are surely no guarantees, no magic bullets, and no time to lose. So today is the day we really must start anew to build a biracial, biethnic, and non-tribal America, an America that is united in judging how well our nation is doing, not by how well off the privileged few are doing, but by how well off the rest of our sisters and brothers are doing. A nation not satisfied until the economic and social injustices of the past and present are fully rectified. For only then will we have won the long and difficult struggle that lies ahead. Well, I invite us all to undertake this struggle in the full confidence that victory can and will be ours.
On September 17, 2020, at least six anti-racist activists were arrested in an action denouncing the Colorado police, notably for the murder of Elijah McClain. In the summer of 2019, three Aurora, Colorado police officers put 23-year-old McClain in a chokehold, and medics injected him with ketamine. The young violinist and massage therapist went into cardiac arrest and was pronounced brain dead. He died 3 days later. The social justice activists now face a litany of felony charges and possible decades in prison on charges that include kidnapping. Four of those arrested, Russell Roach, Lillian House, Joel Northam, and Eliza Lucero, are considered protest leaders and are members of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Police made a spectacle of the arrests, sending what many assert is a threatening message to other activists. Police followed Russell Roosh to Home Depot, where they arrested him in the parking lot. Five police cars surrounded Lillian House as she was driving, and a SWAT team was dispatched to Joel Northam's home. According to the 30-page arrest affidavits, the police used live stream footage, call transcripts, and social media posts to build their case against those arrested. Joining us to talk about these prosecutions is one of the four protest leaders, Lillian House. Lillian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Who was Elijah McClain, and why did the police murder him?
Elijah McClain was a 23-year-old black man in Aurora, Colorado. He was a really unique, gentle, kind person. When he was murdered, he was actually just dancing on his way home from the convenience store where he'd gone to pick up a tea for his cousin. And, you know, there's really no reason for why the Aurora police murdered him, except for that, you know, this is what the police are empowered to do to black people, you know, at will in America. And, you know, Elijah was on his way home. He was wearing a ski mask and dancing. He wore a ski mask frequently because he suffered from a blood disorder, which made him frequently get cold. And so he wore, you know, face coverings to stay warm when he went outside. And somebody called 911 on him. But they explicitly mentioned he didn't sound dangerous, or he didn't look dangerous, he didn't look armed. Nonetheless, when the police rolled up on him, within 10 seconds, they were physically confronting him, choking him, and then beating him at length, which actually ended his life.
On June 27th, protesters gathered in front of the Aurora Municipal Building for a special violin visit, vigil for McClain. Did the police respect that peaceful vigil?
This is a notorious incident for the Aurora Police Department. This violin vigil was held because Elijah himself was a self-taught violinist. He loved music, and that really touched people about him. And so violinists from all over Colorado, and actually people from all over the world, flew in who had heard about Elijah's case and held this, you know, really beautiful violin vigil tribute to him. And, you know, families were all gathered on the grass, and there was a small group of protesters that was, you know, standing in front of this police line that was, you know, dressed in their highly militarized gear, and they were standing there, you know, confronting them. And the Aurora police sent in this entire team of riot police, and they came swarming onto this vigil, using the justification of this small group of protesters that was really just standing in front of the police. And the riot police brought in tear gas, they brought in pepper spray, and they just started unleashing it. And, you know, children were getting gassed. It was just a nightmarish scene as these violinists were trying to, you know, play on in this chaos. The brutality was really, I mean, this is indicative of the way that the Aurora police saw and met these protests. No matter how peaceful or lawful they were, they found an excuse to come in and suppress them.
I understand that vigil attendees, two of whom are members of the local police accountability task force, have actually sued the police department.
Yeah. I mean, they correctly believe that this is a violation of their rights, that this was unjustified force.
Tell us about the circumstances of your arrest, Lillian, and your subsequent detention.
Yeah. Well, so myself and several other of the you know, leading organizers of this summer of protests. So the violin vigil was really just one day out of an entire summer of protests, where, you know, hundreds and thousands of people in Aurora continued to come out week after week and month after month, demanding justice through peaceful protests. And this was a historic movement for Aurora. I mean, truly unprecedented. And so myself and other leaders of this peaceful movement, which had, you know, shook the Aurora police, honestly, to their core. We were picked up on September 17th out of the blue. This was weeks after the latest protest. And, you know, we were stopped. I was just driving. I just left my home when all of a sudden I was surrounded by police cars. Several other organizers were picked up at their homes. One of them had a SWAT team and a tank sent to his apartment. So out of the blue, we had these really dramatic arrests. We weren't told what we were being charged with. And, you know, all of a sudden we were taken to the jail and locked up there. And three of us were held for 8 days, which is many times over, you know, how long they are supposed to be able to hold you without, you know, taking you to a bond hearing. And this was during COVID. So we were locked up. We didn't really know our full charges, held for 8 days. And then we were released to find out that we were being charged with an incredible list of crimes, which had really no basis in reality. I'm personally charged with 25 charges. 12 of them are felonies, and together they could carry 48 years in prison, all related to peaceful protests that we held this summer.
Lillian, what kind of message do arrest tactics as high-profile as these were send to the general public?
These arrests were certainly appear to be, you know, deliberately designed in every way to inflict terror on the movement. I mean, especially since people know us as not just as leaders, but as leaders of these peaceful protests. And I think the message that it sends in these really dramatic out of the blue arrests that happen, you know, months after some of the charges are from June. And so, you know, charges that are that were being hit with months after the fact, it sends the message to people that, you know, no matter how peaceful you are, even if you're within your rights in standing up to the police, you never know when you might be picked up. They have the power to come after you when they decide to, even if you've done things, you know, what you're told is the right way. And what they showed this movement is that they have the power to arbitrarily abduct you, arrest you, take you out of your life, put you in jail. And now, you know, put us through this grueling months-long court process and, you know, potentially put us in prison. That's a really dangerous message to send to, you know, here there were thousands of people who came out for the first time this summer to stand up to what they were seeing was really unjustified and could not continue in our community. But this is also a message to the millions, the tens of millions of people who came out for the first time all over the country this summer against the racist terror of the police. And it's telling them that, yeah, you think you have rights, but when you take them far enough to challenge the police and the prosecutors, well, we don't care what your rights are. We're going to use our power to punish you. And that's something that needs to be challenged. That can't be allowed to stand.
Lillian, prosecutors allege that activists barricaded 18 police officers in the Aurora Police Department District 1 headquarters, as it was surrounded by about 600 protesters. Can you describe what happened then?
Well, they alleged that we attempted to kidnap 18 police officers. I mean, it really is. It would be laughable if it weren't so serious. This charge carries 12 years in prison. But this was a peaceful protest that marched to a police station, that was just a mile from where Elijah McClain was brutally tortured and murdered by three Aurora police officers. The fact that we held a protest outside of this police precinct is being completely perverted and translated into this ridiculous charge of attempted kidnapping. I mean, this is really a gross violation of our rights. And it's something that has gained the attention of a lot of different, you know, people who participate in protests. The idea that if you go to a place of power and you protest outside of it, that they can say that you kidnapped the people inside. This has to be challenged, particularly, you know, the labor forces have said, what does this make a picket then? What does it make a picket outside of a building if this protest was a kidnapping?
Lillian, you were charged, as you mentioned, with 25 different counts. They're all frightening. The attempted kidnapping, as you've mentioned, engaging in a riot without a weapon, attempting to influence a public servant, inciting a riot with damage, giving command and obstructing a highway. Why did you receive more charges than your colleagues?
Well, I mean, it's not really logical. It's a difficult question to answer because, of course, these charges aren't really based in reality in any kind of actual criminal activity that I would have engaged in. But certainly I was one of the most visible, organizers in this movement. I have been here fighting for Elijah before there were huge crowds out. I mean, Aurora Police and the Aurora Police Chief know who I am. I've been here since literally the day after Elijah was killed. The spirit of our movement has been uncompromising. We've been saying since Elijah was killed that there needs to be accountability, and I think that that's put a target on us, despite the fact that we've done, you know, that we've led this protest movement in an entirely peaceful manner.
Before we continue the discussion, I'm sure that our listeners are eager to hear what they can do to come to your defense. Do you have a website? Can you tell us how we can contact you all?
Yeah, support from the movement and from people all around the country is really crucial to defeating this case. People everywhere can call on the district attorneys to drop the charges. There's a website, denverdefense.org, which is the website of the National Committee for Justice in Denver. This is a formation that came together following these arrests, that's made up of, you know, constitutional rights lawyers, civil rights lawyers, educators, labor leaders, people, you know, in different positions, all both locally and all around the country, who are standing against this case. And, you know, on that website, there are ways to express your condemnation for this case, including signing a petition. If you're part of an organization, you know, signing in a solidarity statement. But also, we would really urge people to write the district attorneys. Those addresses are also on the website. If you can, to donate to the defense fund. This is really a stunningly long fight that we're embroiled in, and there's, you know, several of us activists caught up in this, so, you know, that is also extremely helpful. But that's denverdefense.org. And also I want to say that Heidi Boghossian is one of the initial signers of the National Committee for Justice in Denver, and you know, all of this support has just been incredibly meaningful to us and to this fight to drop the charges.
Lillian, tell us about the status of your case.
So we've been in this for 5 months now, and we are just going to arraignment on Monday. We have charges in two different counties in Aurora, where protests spanned this summer. And in one of the counties, we have our arraignment on March 1st. And then in the other county, Adams County, where we have this attempted kidnapping charge, we have a preliminary hearing on March 9th. So things are really getting rolling here. We have a legal team that's come together, and it's really a strong team among myself, Eliza Lucero, and Joel Northam.
And have your lawyers talked to you about speaking out or not speaking out about the case?
Well, when we first got, well, even when we were still in jail, we were being advised, you know, that the standard advice from any criminal defense attorney is to keep your mouth shut, that it carries risk to speak out. But that wasn't an option for us, because we really believe that, you know, a lot of this, of what's happening, is motivated by, you know, the Aurora police and the prosecutor's desire to silence us. We're being targeted because we've been speaking out about their criminality, but this criminality does have to end for the safety of our community, for, you know, if we're going to see justice for Elijah McClain, We have to continue fighting. I mean, Elijah's case is still open. There's still the question of whether these cops will face prosecution. And, you know, the movement of the public has been the force that has kept Elijah McClain's case from being buried. And so it's really not an option for us to be quiet. And also, this case depends on people speaking out against it. I mean, of course, it's completely unfounded, and I don't think that it will stand up in court. These charges are ridiculous. But we also, you know, really depend on people hearing about this. It's important, and we need to demand that the district attorneys drop this entire case.
We have a few minutes left. How did you get involved, if you don't mind sharing, with the Party for Socialism and Liberation? We are friends with and greatly respect Brian Becker.
Yeah, me too. I got involved with the PSL about 3 years ago now, actually more than that. I had been, you know, politically active for a while, and particularly actually the first wave of the Black Lives Matter protests were really a pivotal, you know, moment for me. I grew up out east, and I went to some of those first protests on the East Coast, and it really made importance of protest really real for me, that, you know, these struggles are life and death, and that, you know, if we see things that are wrong, that we have to fight them. And so I had been, you know, going to protests for a while, and I got involved with the PSL because I wanted to be an organizer. I really wanted to get involved with an organization that was thoughtful, that was really focused on building community power and leading struggles that are, you know, well organized. And that was certainly the right decision. We've been a really influential force, certainly in bringing organization and direction to the struggle for justice for Elijah McClain. You know, that's why you see that the majority of the people targeted are PSL organizers, because we've been a force that's brought, you know, real leadership to the struggle and kept it going. And that's what attracted me to PSL.
Lillian House, it's been very informative to be able to speak with you. Can you share with our listeners the website again so they can help this situation?
DenverDefense.org. And if you're on social media, on Instagram and Facebook, it's Justice in Denver.
Lillian, you've been amazing, and we really applaud your tenacity on behalf of Elijah's case and social justice in general. We will be following your case closely.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. The thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late.
When Trump was president, the Democrats called him Putin's poodle. They falsely claimed that Russia influenced the election and caused Hillary Clinton to lose to Trump. Clinton famously said, quote, "All roads lead to Russia." But the truth of the matter was quite different. Despite Trump's seemingly adoration of Putin as a strong man, American policy towards Russia was not completely friendly. The question now is, what will Biden do? The risk of nuclear war with Russia has been a grave concern since the Cold War of the 1950s. Under Trump and Obama before him, American nuclear policies were such that the threat of war, including accidental war, was never reduced. With Biden as president, will this change? Will there be a restoration of nuclear treaties and a de-escalation? We speak today with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. McGovern was a founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. The group was formed initially to oppose America's disastrous war with Iraq. McGovern is an expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union. He briefed President George Bush daily on the situation with Russia. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Before we get into our topic of Russia, we know that you've been active and a great supporter of Julian Assange. What's the current status of his situation, and what is at stake?
Well, there's an awful lot at stake, like freedom of the press, like the First Amendment, like intimidating investigative journalists from saying anything untoward about the United States, least of all war crimes. My friend Julian, and I called him my friend because we are friends, and I used to visit him in the Ecuadorian embassy where he was holed up to escape what he's facing now, extradition. Right now, he is in Belmarsh prison, having been, quote, dismissed, end quote, by the magistrate judge a couple months ago. The idea is that they'll just keep him in Belmarsh, maximum security prison, forever until the appeal that the U.S. is making now under Joe Biden against the her decision, the judge's decision, not to extradite. So he languishes there. And why? Well, because he jumped bail several years ago, for which he has already paid the price of imprisonment, and they're just not going to let him go. Why? Well, I believe that they're trying to kill him slowly with COVID, or just have him fall apart because he is in bad psychological condition, and that would suit them just fine. The bottom line is he's an example to others who would point out U.S. war crimes. Look, you don't do that because the long arm of U.S., quote, justice, end quote, is going to get you, and it's going to put you away forever.
Ray, when I last saw you on a video, you had grown a beard. I would have mistaken you for Rip Van Winkle. What's the meaning of the beard?
Well, actually, I prefer Lev Tolstoy. It's not a frivolous reason, actually. When I saw how disheveled, how unkempt, Julian Assange looked as they unceremoniously dragged him out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London almost 2 years ago now, I thought, well, how can I find some way to identify with my friend Julian, to express solidarity with him? And I decided, well, I'd let myself be just as disheveled as he seemed. He had been denied a razor, by the way. He couldn't cut his hair. I can, but I have not for almost 2 years now. And, it's not only a sign of solidarity. If people forget about Julian Assange, and it's really easy to do because the media here in this country don't give him any coverage at all. The biggest legal case in this century, for sure, and they give him no coverage. So long story short, there's a Russian poem that says, "Druga lushi drug zabudis," and that means even best friends forget their friends. I don't want to forget Julian, so it's real easy in the morning when I look in the mirror or when I pass by a window, I don't forget. I lift up a little prayer for him that he will survive all this.
people, if they want to learn more about it, go to AssangeDefense.org. We have, as our honorary chair people, we have Daniel Ellsberg, Alice Walker, and Noam Chomsky, three of the great public intellectuals in the world, really. And nevertheless, it doesn't get much coverage. So if people want to go to AssangeDefense.org, they can see what's going on with us.
Let me interject here and say that under the aegis of that group, a Unitarian church in Milwaukee held a Zoom thing on Julian, and the big draw was Niels Melzer, who is the UN rapporteur on torture, and he and I spent the hour and 15 minutes dissecting all this business, me from a personal point of view, Niels, of course, from a legal point of view. He is eloquent. He dispelled all this garbage about Julian Assange being accused of rape. He was never accused of rape. Niels Melzer, you may know, went to Sweden. He speaks Swedish. He looked at the police records and found they were all forged, that the women involved never intended something like this, and that the charges or allegations, there were never any real charges, allegations that Julian is a rapist, which what most Americans believe of Julian, are completely unfounded. So if you want, just Google Niels Melzer and Ray McGovern. You'll come up with some really good stuff from Niels.
Thanks, Ray. Let's turn our attention now to the Russian situation. When Biden was vice president in the Obama administration, the United States succeeded in its policy of regime change in the Ukraine, which is an important country that borders Russia to the south. Neocon Victoria Nuland led the successful effort to overturn the democratically elected president of the Ukraine. She might be number three in the Biden administration if she's confirmed as the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Rick Sterling has written that she has had a hand in nearly every U.S. intervention in the past 30 years, all of which have been foreign policy disasters. Your thoughts on Victoria Nuland and what might be in store if she gets confirmed?
Well, I'm praying very hard that she doesn't get confirmed. She orchestrated what many savants have called the most blatant coup in history. Why? Well, because she advertised it 2.5 weeks in advance, inadvertently, but very vocally, in an intercepted conversation with our ambassador at that time in Kiev, Ukraine. She forecast the whole coup, and she told the ambassador who she wanted to pick to come in, do the government, be the new government of Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians reacted to that. And they reacted to that simply because their main and their only all-weather, all-winter port is in Sevastopol in Crimea, and they weren't about to let that fall to NATO. So the whole thing started the downturn in relations between Moscow and Washington. And then when MH17, the Malaysian aircraft, was shot down on the 17th, of 2014, then all hell broke loose, because then we were able to persuade the Europeans, oh, the Russians did it, without sharing any evidence with them. And the Europeans tucked tail and said, oh, the Russians did it, and they were persuaded to institute rather severe sanctions, economic sanctions, which hurt the Europeans more than it hurt the Russians, and lots more than it ever hurt the U.S. economy.
Ray, when Nuland served under Obama and Biden, it was thought that the ultimate aim was regime change in Russia and the overthrow of Putin. Is this on the table now? Since Obama's, there's been what some are calling a, quote, turn to Russia and China.
Well, Heidi, that's what the Navalny thing is all about. The notion that the very adept Russian secret services poisoned Navalny, poisoned Skripal a couple of years ago with what's associated with Russia, the trademark poison, Novichok. I mean, hello. It's like leaving their calling card at the scene of the crime, you know? It's like picking the only poison, the only method of killing that is identified with Russia. It doesn't parse. It doesn't parse at all. Navalny is in receipt of lots of advice and lots of money from Western intelligence services. Let me read you something that it's very, very brief, two sentences. And it turns out that the Defense Intelligence Agency had this all put together after Ukraine in a major paper called National Security Strategy, December 2015. Quote, this is the Defense Intelligence Agency. The Kremlin is concerned that the U.S. is laying the groundwork for regime change in Russia, a conviction further reinforced by the events in Ukraine. Moscow views the United States as the critical driver behind the crisis in Ukraine and believes that the overthrow of former Ukrainian President Yanukovych is the latest move in a long-established pattern of U.S.-orchestrated regime change efforts. End quote, Lieutenant General Vincent Stewart, Director, Defense Intelligence Agency. Whoa! They got it right. They published that. Now, as a kind of a footnote, why do you think that the powers that be, that is the head of the CIA and the National Intelligence Director, excluded the Defense Intelligence Agency when they were doing that rump memo assessing that Putin authorized the, quote, interference, hacking of the DNC emails showed what Hillary was doing with respect to Bernie Sanders? Why do you think the DIA was excluded from all that stuff? Indeed, they blamed it on the GRU. And who has primary responsible for GRU, which is the Russian Military Intelligence Agency? Well, DIA does. So DIA was excluded. The State Department was excluded. It was a rump effort. And now we know that it has been critiqued, this bedrock analysis that said Putin interfered with the election. It's been critiqued, but the powers that be will not release the critique of that memo. Because Trump was basically a coward and he wouldn't insist that this too be included in the documents that were declassified.
Ray McGovern, talk about the threat of nuclear war with Russia and China.
Well, you know, this is nothing to be taken lightly. Doomsday clock, most people know what that is down to 100 seconds. 100 seconds. And, you know, there are many examples of how close we came to having this kind of, to being dead, all right? Now, for those of you who have not read Daniel Ellsberg's Doomsday Machine, you really need to. One thing he talks about was during Cuba. There were Soviet submarines around Cuba that were out of communication with Moscow, okay? They had nuclear charges on their torpedoes. There was one submarine that had decided, whoa, you know, the depth charges, the war must be over. What are we going to do? And the captain said, we're going to shoot those torpedoes and destroy as many U.S. Naval vessels as were out there. Now, he needed the approval of what they call the political officer, who was also a Navy captain. And the political officer says, no, yet, we don't have instructions from Moscow. Now, they surfaced, found out that that there was no war, but there would have been, and you and I wouldn't be speaking right here today if Archipov, which is the Navy captain's name, hadn't countermanded the Navy submariner who had pretty much ordered the nuclear charges to be shot fired at the U.S. ships. So that's one example. I want to juice one more because it's very close to home. Mel Goodman is a good friend of mine. He worked in the same branch as Bobby Gates. I happen to be the branch chief. Bobby Gates, most people know, became Secretary of Defense as well as CIA director. Now, in a letter to the editor of the Washington Post, Mel Goodman pointed out that the nuclear scare in 1983 also came close to doing us all in. We were doing a big exercise. We knew the Russians were watching it closely, and it looked so real to them that they were going to retaliate, okay? We also had a British spy. His name was Gordievsky, and he reported that, hey, these guys are taking this very seriously. There's going to be war unless you knock down, unless you attenuate, for example, the vice president's participation in this war rehearsal, okay? Now, why do I mention this? Well, Mel Goodman and a couple of very stalwart analysts went to Robert Gates, who was the deputy director at the time, and said, look, we have to call the White House. Tell them to call off this exercise that Russians think it's for real. Gates said, nah, they're only bluffing. So what Goodman did was go to the next office where Director Casey sat, and he said, Director Casey, I hate to do this out of channels, but you need to call the National Security Advisor right now because the Russians are taking this thing seriously. And Casey did that. They attenuated the play of the war game, and we had peace. Now, that's 1983. That's at a time when Ronald Reagan was calling the Russians the evil empire. It's after the KAL-007 was downed by the Russians intentionally, believing it to be a spy plane, but intentionally. And so tensions were at an acme, okay? And that's what happened. So doomsday clock, 100 seconds, man, that's not much, particularly since many of these arms control agreements have been frittered away by both Bush and Trump. And all we have left, really, is one that's called New Start. And to his credit, and this is good news, Biden didn't make any bones about re-upping on that for the automatic five-year extension without any claims that it had to be bettered or had to be amended or anything like that. So arms control seems to be one area in which we can talk to the Russians. We have talked to the Russians. And after Biden did talk to Putin, the announcement from the White House said there could be progress. We're looking into ways to conclude even more arms control and security arrangements between our two countries. Now, the New York Times didn't say that, didn't report that. Washington Post didn't report that. And that goes to the question about what Americans really know about Russia.
Eisenhower, in his farewell address in 1960, famously spoke about the threat to America of the military-industrial complex. Ray, what's the nature of that complex today? Has it expanded, and what does it consist of?
Well, Heidi, as many people know, Eisenhower wanted to talk about the military-industrial congressional complex. So already, back in 1961, I guess it was, his farewell address, already Congress was pocketing lots of money from the Raytheons and the Lockheeds of this world, using that to win elections, then appropriating money for arms making and arms selling, getting some of the take from that from the arms manufacturers and sellers, getting reelected, appropriating. I mean, it's a vicious cycle. Is this a great country or what? So that was already 1961. He was persuaded, oh, no, military industrial is bad enough. You're going to get a lot of heat for this. Now, I use a different acronym. It rhymes with Mickey Mouse. It's much more serious than Mickey Mouse, but that's a good way to remember it. It's the Mickey Matt, okay? You got a pencil? Military Industrial Congressional Intelligence Media Academia Think Tank Complex. That's a mouthful, but includes virtually all of the what Eisenhower called the MIC, the military industrial complex. Now, why do I say media as if they're all caps there? Well, because the media is the linchpin. It won't work without the media. Who controls the media? The rest of the Mickey Mat. So, you know, it's pretty incestuous. The media is the big thing here, and I've been saying for at least 15 years now that the biggest change that I have witnessed in the body politic in this country is the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. It's worse now.
What drives American nuclear policy? A huge expansion of the nuclear arsenal is being planned. The Obama-Biden administration promised to do away with nuclear arms, but instead committed $1 trillion to building up the nuclear stockpile and modernizing nuclear production facilities.
Just unexplainable idiocy. Well, it's not unexplainable. It's explainable by the Mickey math. Let me give you one small vignette here. Raytheon is one of the big players here. And the head of Raytheon said recently, look, quote, look, peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon. So I think it remains an area where we will continue to see solid growth in arms making and arms sales. Now, the nuclear updating that's going to cost $1 trillion is just crazy. Our country can't afford it. Our country, many of people kind of really, really down, not only because COVID, but because of policies that feed the military-industrial complex and not them. There's going to have to be some accountable thing here. And if Biden doesn't wise up to the fact that people are going to realize that 60 cents of every dollar they pay in taxes goes to the likes of Raytheon and Lockheed. For what? For systems that don't work, but systems that really feed and give employment to the top 10%, top 1%, some people say. So social inequities have to be addressed, and the only way you can do that really is by reapportioning money. And here's one very lucrative thing that is not only totally unnecessary, that's not only totally feckless when it comes to defending against China or Russia, and it's a place where Biden's going to have to face into it and say, look, we have other uses for this money, and rather than spend as much as the next 10 countries in the world, we've trimmed down the defense budget, find the money, build the infrastructure, and make sure that people are housed and fed.
Ray McGovern, it's been enlightening speaking with you. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, can you tell our listeners how people can get in touch with you and follow your work?
Sure. I have a website. My son runs it for me. It's called raymcgovern.com. I'm also on Twitter. My son always says, Dad, you really got to say this. If you don't get raymcgovern.com, you don't get it.
Your son is right.
So true.
Ray, thank you so much.
Have a great day, Ray. Thanks.
Thank you, Ray.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.